Just before we start today, are you a teacher? Most listeners aren't, because we aim this show at students. But if you are an educator of some form, I just wanted to let you know that I'm co-authoring a special series this month on effective studying with this week's podcast guest, Peps McRae, for his famous ultra-concise, ultra-high-value Evidence Snacks email newsletter. In the three-part series we've put together, I'm sharing some of my all-time favourite tips and tricks that I've learned over the years to help embed smarter study strategies in your school, helping students study smarter, not harder, going beyond the research recommendations to figure out exactly what we need to be telling students to help them put good ideas into practice. In the email series, I'm even giving away some of my teaching resources so you can pick up some ready-to-teach lessons so you can deliver these ideas directly into your school. So you get slides, a little video, and even a workbook for your learners. Follow the link in the episode description to catch up on any emails in the series that you might have missed so far, and then sign up to Peps's Evidence Snacks email list to get the rest of the series delivered directly to your inbox. For everyone else listening, all my non-teacher friends studying hard for their exams at school, university and more, I just wanted to say, especially if your exams are coming up soon over the next few weeks, hang in there, my friends, keep going, you've got this. And now, here's today's episode.
Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast. By the time this episode airs, hopefully, I'll be holding a new little baby. So this week and last, I've been bringing you a couple of archive episodes, a couple of gems from way back that you may have overlooked that I think are well worth revisiting. Last week, we looked back on a classic conversation with learning scientists co-founder Dr. Carolina Kuppertetzel, talking about spaced learning, incredibly important stuff. And today, we're replaying a fascinating discussion I had as part of that same series I brought out about 3 years ago. And this one is with Oliver Caviglioni. Ollie is a very influential figure in the world of evidence-based education practice and in high demand for keynote speeches at conferences and a well-known author, particularly to teachers here in the UK. And he has a particular interest in visualization and has a really distinctive and very interesting take on using various visual strategies to support learning and how that kind of ties in to the underlying science of kind of how the brain works and what we know about the kind of cognitive psychology of visual strategies in learning. So I think you'll really enjoy looking back on this episode, rediscovering it if you listened to it before, or listening to it the first time if you haven't had a chance to get that far back in the archives yet. So without further ado, let me hand over to 2021 me to introduce you to this episode in conversation with Oliver Caviglioni. Enjoy. There's this very famous idea that some of us are visual learners, which means that we learn best via pictures, whereas others are auditory learners and need to hear information in order to learn it. And there are others still that are perhaps kinesthetic learners, and that means they need to move or see videos or structures to remember things. This may be a really famous idea, this idea of different learning styles, but it's just not true. It's perhaps one of the most widely talked about of all the myths about learning and the brain. But having said all of that, it may not be true that some of us are visual learners and some are not, but there's certainly a lot of truth in the idea that learning visually can help all of us. So today, we're going to be understanding more about the science of learning visually, organising information visually and spatially, and how all that can help us to learn faster and remember more. You may remember a couple of episodes ago hearing Dr. Yana Weinstein-Jones talking to us about six learning strategies that are well supported by modern psychology research. Well, one of these strategies was dual coding, the power of combining words and pictures. The power of learning visually, including using this dual coding technique, as well as organizing information clearly in a visual structure, can be really handy when it comes to getting our heads around ideas, especially more complex concepts, and to committing all that knowledge to memory. Using visuals in learning, then, is a really fascinating area, but as I've said, often widely misunderstood. So, if you're wanting to know more about the theory of what works and really how to apply it in practice to level up your own learning, there's really only one name that comes to mind. And that is ex-headmaster, serial author, and learning scientist illustrator, Oliver Caviglioli. And I'm very happy to say that the man himself is here on the show with me today. Oliver, a very warm welcome. Would you introduce yourself and tell us a little of what you do?
I'm an information designer. I used to be a head teacher of a special school for a decade, and then a trainer and author. But when I looked to see what I did, which is often to translate research and text-heavy books and articles into somewhat more compelling visuals, I realised that although the visual aspect is what people notice, what I'm doing is fundamentally looking at information and reshaping it. And when I mention this at the beginning of my courses, and then I declare to their amusement that they too are information designers, pretty soon during the course of the day, they realise, actually, yes, that is what teachers do. They don't give a diet of straight information that teachers find. They carve it, chunk it, sequence it. They're really designing the information for best access and understanding.
That's a really interesting way of describing it. What sort of first sparked your interest in information design or kind of visual presentation of information?
Well, my father was an architect. And if you've ever been around architects, particularly of a certain generation, nowadays architects are just part of a team. But in my father's generation, they were gods. And they could declare how people should live. And so throughout my childhood, I had this informal education, which is receiving his opinion about the taste of napkins and chairs and my trousers and that painting and that advert and everything. Everything's designed, and he had an opinion about everything, which was a really wonderful way. It was tiresome. You know, it was so tiresome, I decided not to go into the design world. And then I was a very early user of an Apple Mac back in 1989. And one of the books that explained how to use it was by someone called Richard Saul Wurman, who was a self-declared information architect. And then he pretty much started a whole industry. So, for example, in education at the moment, we're talking a lot about knowledge curriculum, but no one seems to be yet interested in what is knowledge and how do you structure it. You know, we talk about knowledge as if it comes together in an ethereal, natural format, but it's humans who shape it. And it's that shaping of information into knowledge, which I just find fascinating.
One thing I wanted to ask about in a bit of detail was the subject of one of your books, Dual Coding. Perhaps by way of kind of segue into that, I know you do a really nice explanation of the model of learning, so from attention into working memory, consolidation into long-term memory, and then recall. Perhaps you just sort of talk us through that model briefly by way of kind of theoretical background, I suppose, to some of the things we might be talking about in a minute.
I think we often forget, even in learning circles, that we have developed evolutionary in terms of our psychology. So it's only a short period of time that we've been wearing clothes inside buildings and do all these sophisticated things. Well, we developed ourselves through our survival in order to notice things that happen really quickly. We notice movement because movement is potential danger. By being able to focus on movement, by definition, it means we don't focus on many, 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 many other things. So one aspect of human that we need to bear in mind when we're looking at learning is that we don't notice a lot of things. It's the not noticing of a lot of things and not remembering a lot of things that allows us to survive. Otherwise, we'd be overloaded with information. So attention is absolutely crucial. There's almost no learning without attention. Attention, organizing, and recall pretty much captures learning. So we're going to learn only that which we pay attention to. And that which we pay attention to, we hold in our working memory. And working memory is our awareness or even our consciousness, what we're aware of now. So, you know, our awareness and consciousness is fleeting and it's not permanent, it's transient. And in that transience, we can only hold on to a little amount of information. Now, back in 1956, George Miller came up with this phrase, the magic number 7.
And what did he mean by, what was he meaning when he said 7?
We can hold about 7, potentially 9 bits of information. But what no one ever focused on or remembered or explained was that those bits of information are simple digits or really short, simple words. When we're dealing with concepts, and you know, a concept doesn't need to be complex, but it is concept. It's more like 4 ± 1. As a teacher, think of the children in front of you, the students, whatever age they are. They have 4 slots in their head. Fill those 4 slots up and you're in trouble, because you always need to have at least 1 slot free to process the other material. That's for children who are nearly adults, who are very good at the academic game. So when you're dealing with children who are younger, who aren't academically fluent, you're talking about 1 or 2 slots. I often use the analogy of a garage. You imagine a garage that's got 1,000 items in it. If in your garage you removed all cupboards, shelves, trays, boxes, bottles, you would find it very, very tedious to find anything.
Absolutely.
And you would give up pretty soon. And so pretty much with our memory, we organize things like we organize things in the world. We put things together that go together. So you tend to put electrical items and do-it-yourself items together. So that's the organizing part. And then because it's organized and we can find it, in the retrieval part, remembering it, that's more likely to happen. Mm-hmm. And of course, much stuff gets lost. And forgetting is very crucial. There was a famous Russian in the 1930s who had the curse of never being able to forget anything. And so his life was unbearable. So we need to forget things. Where dual coding comes in is this process of learning something, psychologists term encoding. Well, dual coding is double encoding. And so we get information in through our attention.
So this is a new item being admitted to the garage, so
yes,
to speak.
Indeed. And they come in through 2 different entrances. So there are 2 channels. There's a verbal and a visual channel. They work separately. They can work simultaneously. And also, and here's the dual coding part, is that if the verbal and visual channel are inputting the same meaning, so if we're going to learn vocabulary in French, we're going to have the word cat, we have the word chat, and then image, they have associative connections. In other words, they link up, they mean something together. And so when we have encoding, which to say learning, we learn it in 2 formats. And Professor Paul Kirshner calls that double-barreled learning because it leaves a double memory trace. And hence, at the end of the cycle, the retrieval cycle, you have a double chance of it being retrieved because it could be triggered either and word or image. And that's dual coding theory. And I tell people on my course after about 20 minutes, I could go home now because that's dual coding theory.
Done.
Images allow you to do parallel processing. It's kind of a term that we know from computing now. So you can do more things at one time. You can zoom into a detail in relation to the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Larkin and Simon, 2 psychologists in 87, did these series of tests with university undergraduates in which half of them were given text-only explanation of a concept in physics. The other group were given a diagram. They used explanations as well, but they had a diagram as well to support it. And tested on their speed and accuracy of their understanding, those with a diagram overwhelmingly and repeatedly scored more highly than those with only the text. And the reason they gave was that diagrams are more computationally efficient, and so they have computation advantage. And this is just a psychological term. If you were to ask on a man on the street or a woman on the street, they'd say, or a child in a school, they'd say, oh, it's easier to suss out. It's easier to understand.
One of the things I wanted to ask, because we do have lots of student listeners as well as teachers, when I'm kind of talking to students about the science of learning and all the good stuff that modern cognitive psychology recommends for their studies and their exam preparation, it's not straightforward, but it's relatively accessible to kind of talk about retrieval practice and how you want to test yourself, use flashcards, that sort of thing. You know, space your studies out, so kind of revisit that at intervals, do your spaced learning. One of the areas that starts to run into difficulties is when you get sort of past space retrieval practice and into things like dual coding, where it's perhaps not immediately obvious for lots of students, well, okay, this theory is all very well, but how do I apply this to my exam revision? You know, perhaps I'm no good at art, I can't draw, you know, what am I supposed to do with all this? I wonder if you might be able to kind of speak to that, you know, so any kind of practical ideas for how students might be able to apply dual coding theory in their exam revision?
Yes. I'm going to start with teachers and the use of knowledge organisers, in which they, sometimes under initial difficulty, they'll be able to identify the key component parts.
So a knowledge organiser being a sort of perhaps a one sheet summary of a...
Basically their lists of key parts. And that makes students' job far easier in knowing what's important and what I can use for my flashcards and my retrieval practice, which is useful. The problem is the word knowledge organiser. It doesn't really do much organising. It's just a bunch of lists. Mm. So I still find them very useful, but they are insufficient in the sense that I've likened them to ingredients. So you can't cook without the ingredients. So we need to learn the ingredients off by heart. But the exam doesn't ask you just to regurgitate lists.
Sure.
Some parts do, but other parts ask you to do the equivalent of a recipe, which is to say, get certain parts of the ingredients and mix them together and relate them and connect them.
Yeah.
So knowledge organisers and their retrieval through space practice and all the other techniques are essential because you need to learn stuff off by heart. But it's insufficient because it doesn't link them together. So here's just one technique that students could use. Create a graphic organizer, which is another word for diagram. You don't need to spend any time drawing. It's basically, we call them a visual and they call them an organizer, but they're only words. But they're words that are organized in a non-linear format. And there are many types of them. So if you're dealing something that's a chemical or a geographic process or history, then you do a timeline. Mm-hmm. Or a variation of a flowchart, which could elaborate at different aspects. And it could include things like yes, no, what if. If you're looking at defining something, what the nature of a revolution or a particular revolution, then you would then group things together. In the same way at a garage, you wouldn't put your decorating things with electricity things. You group things together. So you would have main branches, and then you would have a word for the main branch, and then the branches would split up into other parts. So you might go decorating, then you say, well, there's the preparation, there's the painting, there's the whatever. So you branch things off. So creating it itself is really powerful. So here's the really significant part, and I'll go back and explain and validate some of it in terms of evidence later, but let me explain it first of all. This is for a student on their own. You create it, and then find someone who will listen to you. I don't know who that might be, your neighbour, your mother, your auntie, or whoever.
Sure.
And then with the diagram in front of you, so both can see, put the index finger of the hand that you write with and place it on the middle of the map. And then your map will consist of keywords. Give yourself a discipline and say for every keyword, I need to elaborate that notion into at least two or three sentences. So I want to create a narrative, an explanation, so my partner really understands. So imagine your partner is going to be tested. So you really have a commitment to them understanding. So forget yourself. Just think about your partner understanding. So someone who's naive, who doesn't know it very well, may be quite useful. And then as you elaborate the point of that keyword, move your finger and actually physically trace the line, not with a pen, not with gloves, or not hovering above, but make a real physical contact throughout. Mm. And then you will go through the whole map. And also point out cross-branch references. Then thank your partner, hide your piece of paper away, get a clean sheet of paper and put your finger without the pen in the middle of the paper and just realize that try and recreate the image which was in front of your eyes. And you will, to a great extent, be able to do that. Imagine yourself putting on a tape recorder or other means by which you replay the explanation you just gave to your listener. And also move your hand in the shape that the diagram formed and start speaking. Pick up the pen and you will be able to redraw that map, that diagram, to a phenomenal 100% improve. Then, with the same principles we apply to other forms of recall, do it at a later date, maybe half a day later, and then 2 days later, and then a week later, whatever loop you find works for you. And why that works is that the non-linear arrangements of the diagram is the closest we have to the structure of your schema. So in our heads, when psychologists depict a schema, and schema is your garage, or more than your garages, are garages of garages of how you understand things.
Yeah.
Hyper interconnected organization. They never, ever depict them as a bunch of sentences, apart from the odd poem you might recite off by heart. Everything, they always draw them as dots and a non-linear web. So yeah, the diagram is a perfect fit, and so is more easily assimilated and accommodated into your schema. The other thing, of course, is that you have exerted enormous amount of cognitive effort. One, in creating the map, it's yours and yours only. So you have what's called the generative effect. You've been creating meaning through your organization. And at this point, I want to say, I want you to consider organizing as not being a secretarial task. Organizing is meaning making.
Yeah,
they're almost the same thing spelt differently. And then additionally, you had the cognitive effort of explaining to somebody else. And there's decades of research showing that peer explanation is highly effective, putting it all back into your own words. And the effort of elaborating. So you had a lot of effort by all these ideas, condensing them into keywords and arranging them, connecting them. Now you've got even more cognitive effort in elaborating those keywords with your meaning. So it's meaningful to somebody else because you have an audience, which is the discipline. If you didn't have a partner, you go, oh, yeah, I've got that.
Yeah.
Because we kid ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, and this is the additional bit, and John Sweller has now included this in cognitive load theory, your tracing is what's called embodied cognition. So whilst your working memory is limited and got like these four chunks, you can, so to speak, outsource some of the work of collecting and collating information with your body. And so your body will remember the shape of the diagram. And that isn't at the expense of your cognitive working memory. It's an addition to. So given that psychologists say your working memory is probably the single biggest factor that will determine and limit the degree of learning you engage in, if you now have a way in which you have a hack, you have a cognitive hack to increase the capacity of working memory by outsourcing additional work to your body, it's remarkably effective. Plus the dual coding part of image and a word, put that all together and the effect is just remarkable. So you can do your normal retrieval practice, and this puts it all together. This is the real test. Do all the ingredients merge together meaningfully? And you want to think of like a meal, something that you're baking. It's the meaningful and effective merging of those individual elements together to create a product. Well, you'll need to be writing things in your essay so you're convincing the examiner that what you're saying is you've understood and you've understand the key concepts through your explanation. That is equivalent to baking. You're putting them together into a coherent, meaningful argument.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating, Oliver. I remember, you know, 90s and early 2000s, and mind maps were all the rage back then. And I and many of my peers spent many a long afternoon coming up to exams, sort of drawing these elaborate mind maps, beautifully drawn little pictures in the middle, because that was what you had to do, colouring it in, you know, all sorts of things. And then it would get put in a drawer and never used again, or maybe put on the wall, if you were lucky.
Mark, can I remind you of that wonderful quote?
Please.
Visuals ignored don't teach.
Absolutely. And so kind of what I love about your kind of advice there is you're sort of putting the emphasis very much on using that visual to organize the information and not necessarily wasting time kind of making it look beautiful. But then secondly, you know, what you then do with that. So that's very much the first part of the process. You then go on to teach it your sort of technique with the finger, hacking your working memory to increase capacity, the benefits of teaching it to someone else. And then you recall it for yourself. So you're doing some retrieval practice. And then repeating that retrieval at a later date, so kind of working in some spacing. So, you know, a very, very powerful system.
Yes, you spend a lot of effort creating those maps, and then it's such a pity they all got wasted. Of course, the other thing, in explaining to your partner, you're practicing, that's to say you're rehearsing, you're writing.
Yeah, finding ways to sort of explain things. Yes. And that might ultimately become sentence structures and so forth that you adapt and use in your using your essay.
If your partner, you invite your partner end stage to question and quiz you. Why is that? Doesn't that belong to so-and-so? That becomes even more effective.
Little elaborative interrogation there as well.
Indeed, that is the term.
One other thing I just wanted to ask you about, I know you've sort of obviously got extensive experience leading a special school. I was just curious to get your thoughts on the kind of relevance and application of the kind of wealth of techniques we've been talking about, visualizing data, for the students who might otherwise struggle more than most with their learning.
David Auzubel, a psychologist of the 1960s, introduced, pretty much formalized the use of graphic organizers. He also introduced the notion of an advanced organizer. This is gradually being reintroduced to the public by Professor Paul Kirshner. And what it is if I were to take you to a new town and you were a child, and I wanted you to remember everything about the town, I wouldn't just go down all the side streets and point out all the details. You'd soon be overwhelmed. Nor would I give you a map that was highly detailed. I would give you a simplified map, and we've seen these in tourist guides. I would show you the town square, the post office, the church, the football ground. And having these major landmarks means that when we encounter the details, we start entering the town, I would say, look at these details of these streets, notice the windows, where are we on the map? And then you would say, all right, so I know that these sorts of streets are over here. So what we're doing, and it's a critical part of learning, we're linking the details with the big picture. Or as other people now say, we're zooming in, zooming out. So if teachers create a simplified diagram at the beginning of a topic, so a simplified, stylized one, in which we give students an overview of where they're going. And then during the course of the journey, while you're discovering the details of the topic, point out and question where those details live. This doesn't take up much time. It doesn't distract the more able. The other aspect of such diagrams is they're not transient. Teachers' words disappear. So even if you give a really clear, precise and concise explanation, it disappears. There's also something called a very simple flowchart. So you might, in organising your lesson, think of there being perhaps four or five stages. At each stage, point out what the major stages are, and from that, add the details gradually. It's the same thing as the map, but this time it converts the map into time. So at any one stage, you could ask a student, where are we? Where about on our sequence are we? And so the two are really useful. So where does that detail live in terms of the map of the place? And the timeline tells you what have we studied, what are we studying next? And that reorients the mind. And for students who are more academically gifted, they naturally, by osmosis, are able to cognitively orient themselves. This just makes it explicit.
Yeah.
And for those students who think they do it naturally, but may be inaccurate or insufficient, it gives them a wake-up call.
I was relatively academically comfortable at school. I went on to study at natural sciences at Cambridge, and some of that content I found very challenging at first. And I feel like my life as a learner at university level would have been made a heck of a lot easier by some of the techniques you were just describing.
Your professors, they knew where they were going.
Yeah.
So it all seems obvious because they've been there several times. You forget how different it is when it's the first time.
Absolutely.
There is no path to follow. It's like you're tentatively putting a foot out and then pass somehow just there. It's always tentative.
Absolutely.
And fraught, therefore, with anxiety.
Absolutely.
I mean, the other side of anxiety is excitement, true, but accompanied more often with anxiety than excitement.
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure. Oliver, thank you so much once again. You've shared an awful lot of incredible insights and, very grateful for you giving up the time. In closing, I always conclude with the exam study expert time machine question, where I ask guests, if you have the opportunity to step back in time and you bumped into yourself aged 16 or 17 years old, and you were able to give him a little bit of advice for the future, particularly as regards education, what might you say to him?
I would say form stronger alliances with like-minded staff. In my day, we had just local teacher centres. They gradually disappeared and then there was nothing. I would say form alliances. So for the teacher nowadays, Twitter offers you that. You may feel, if you're not on Twitter, you're the only one. People kind of mock you for being nerdy and reading all those books. You think, oh, perhaps I'm wasting my time. Go on Twitter and you'll find thousands of people just like you and you'll learn so much from each other. So form alliances.
That's great advice. And a beautiful segue to my final question. So if people are wanting to follow you on Twitter, find out more about your works, your published books, for example, where would you point them to?
On Twitter, I live as @OliCav, spelled OliCav. And my website is called OliCav.com, 99% of which is free to download, as long as you follow the Creative Commons principles of not amending it or using it to sell or selling it directly. You can use everything I've got on there for you. The book you mentioned was Dual Coding with Teachers. That's available from Amazon or its publisher, John Catt. The project I'm most engaged in now is I'm using all my design skills, and I'm working with Tom Sherrington, and we've created something called the Teaching Walkthroughs, where working with Nelson Cowan's 4 ±1, we've broken teaching techniques that have been validated by evidence into 5 steps. And if you go to the walkthroughs.co.uk, you'll see the book and the resources we have available. So we're using the same principles for adults learning.
And a great read it is too. I've read both and would highly recommend them. Oliver, thank you so much once again. This has been very excellent. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you again, Oliver, for that fantastic discussion. And I really do highly recommend you consult his published works if you'd like to know more, especially if you are a teacher. You can find links to his books, as well as the other resources just mentioned, in the show notes. Thanks again for listening today. Study smart and stay safe.
If you've got exams coming up, you can now get all of William's favourite tips and tricks to save you time and get you higher grades, all in one handy cheat sheet. Grab your copy at examstudyexpert.com/free tips. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.